and the ghettos play. Spitfire Breeze, the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Welcome to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is 4 after 6, and we have a terribly exciting program in store for you today.
When Nydia Dauphin published a post on HuffPost Canada on May 16th, bells and whistles went off, sirens even. Her crime? Pointing out the resurfacing of blackface minstrelsy in Quebec. Dauphin was responding specifically to the donning of blackface by Mario Jean at the annual comedy award show, Gala des Oliviers. The show aired on Radio Canada. Jean was apparently attempting to impersonate a black comedian. Dauphin's post also included a slideshow of blackface performances by white Quebecers in recent years and provided some much-needed context of the offensiveness of these sightings and her personal observations as a black Quebecer. We, as women of color, lamented the reaction and the outpouring of mischaracterizations and attempts to dismiss Dauphin's remarks. Flat-out defenses of blackface were given in media. The assertion that ugly forms of racism persist in Quebec society were mocked.
As a show that comes together every month to say no to the silencing our voices of women of color, to provide a platform for women of color to have self-determination as they discuss their lived experiences, we felt compelled to spend today's hour looking more closely at racism in Quebec society today. From the resurgence of blackface to the Quebec Soccer Federation's initial ban on the wearing of religious headwear to the hostile reactions in the press at the assertion that racism persists in Quebec today, we are taking to the airwaves to give voice to our experiences of women of color, members of the press, confronting this long-winded discourse on. Hi, welcome to the studio, Malak. You're like 6 minutes late, but that's okay. I still love you. Maybe I'll introduce you later, but to that end, Alyssa Clutterbuck responds to the denials that blackface, slavery, and other forms of anti-black racism form part of Quebec's history. Her piece, "Are People Still Denying That Slaves Were Brought to New France by French Settlers?" And finally, Mercedes Bonaire will be presenting a personal testimony of growing up in Little Burgundy, Montreal. We also have a reading by Lily Dow, The Silencing of Racism in Quebec, which is a book review of Jan Wong's Out of the Blue. And finally, no show on women of color in Quebec would be complete without recent immigrants. And we're super excited to have an illustrious critic, writer, podcaster, and artist, Faria Roisin, in the studio tonight for a live interview. Hi, Faria.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Really? I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
I'm good. Sweating a little bit.
You're sweating a little bit. It's really cool in here, though, so that's nice.
Yeah.
So all this is coming up on Spitfire Radio. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Chains of the world, they seem loose.
It's a bush for moving on. In time, the sun's gonna shine on me nicely.
One day, yeah.
Sun tells me good things are coming, and I ain't gonna not believe. I am looking for freedom.
Sometimes the best way to parse haters hating is a brief wiki-supported history lesson. Let me give you some context. Nydia Dauphin's May 5th blog on Huffington Post Canada, entitled "Why the Hell Are Quebec Comedians Wearing Blackface?" was an astute commentary on the resurgence of blackface minstrelsy donned by white Quebec comedians that offered a moment to pause on the historical roots of blackface, namely the transatlantic slave trade that brought millions of enslaved Africans to the Americas for 3+ centuries. Instead of a constructive dialogue, however, the Post provoked a panicky denial by several journalists that Quebec was ever a place where A, slavery was practiced, or B, blackface minstrelsy was performed. To claim in 2013 that Quebec, or the rest of Canada for that matter, was never a destination for enslaved Africans is silly. If I think about it more seriously, however, I would say it is reckless, deceitful, and beneath anyone who cares about history and truth. If I were charitable, I could say that I don't blame the many, many people I have met in Canada who are ignorant of the practice of the slave trade by the French and the British. I, for one, learned about the Underground Railroad in elementary school and not about the enslaved Africans brought as bondage by French and British settlers. But it is 2013 after all, and I must say, in my more than 6 years on Spitfire, this is at least the fourth time our show has felt compelled to recount Canada's history of slavery. Here are my wiki-supported history tidbits. In 1628, Olivier Lejeune, the first recorded slave in Canada, was brought to New France, originally from Madagascar. Lejeune was forcibly baptized to Catholicism. By 1688, the population of New France, or today's Quebec, was just over 11,500 people. The society was made up primarily of fur traders, missionaries, and farmers settled along the St. Lawrence Valley. To help overcome a shortage of servants and laborers, King Louis XIV granted New France's petition to import black slaves from West Africa. New France soon established its own code noir, defining the control and management of slaves. The code in 1685 set the pattern for policing slavery. It required that all slaves be instructed as Catholics and not as Protestants. It concentrated on defining the condition of slavery and established harsh controls. Slaves had no rights, though the code did enjoin masters to take care of the sick and old. Enslaved Africans were typically referred to as servants, and death rates among slaves were much higher than that of settlers. Unlike its U.S. counterpart example, French settlers also enslaved Aboriginal peoples. These slaves were referred to as pennies. By way of a story, Mary Joseph Angelique, who some of you may have heard of, was the black slave of a rich widow in Montreal. According to Afua Cooper's 2007 award-winning book, The Hanging of Angelique, in 1734, after learning that she was going to be sold and separated from her lover, Angelique allegedly set fire to her owner's house and escaped, but the fire raged out of control, destroying 46 buildings. Captured 2 months later, Mary Joseph Angelique was paraded through the city, then tortured until she confessed to the crime. Angelique's infamous story provides insight on the conditions of slavery in Canada. This version of slavery has differences to the American experience, where large plantations used slaves to fuel the cotton boom of the Industrial Revolution. But make no mistake about it, it was slavery, it was bondage, it was brutal, and it happened here in Montreal. On to minstrelsy. A May 28th post by Professor Charmaine Nelson of McGill University pointed out that Canadian ignorance extends beyond slavery to false claims that blackface minstrelsy has nothing to do with Quebec. But the McCord Museum in downtown Montreal holds broadsheets, photography, advertisements, and other paraphernalia of Canadian minstrel troupes that performed in Canada in blackface throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. As Canada's history of enslavement has been ignored, therefore, so too has the role of white Canadians in the promulgation of blackface minstrelsy. Blackface, for instance, was part of Quebecois entertainer Jean Lapointe's comedy act until the 1980s. Lapointe later became a Canadian senator. Blackface minstrelsy was a popular nostalgic performance, often in front of a live audience and then later on television. Whites used burnt cork and later grease paint or shoe polish to blacken their skin, exaggerate their lips, and wear woolly wigs and ragged clothes. The performance was a way in which whites could lament the end of slavery, using dark humor delivered in song, dance, and jokes that celebrated white fantasies of violence against black bodies. Today, it is widely regarded as an iconic symbol of anti-black racism. Being ignorant about the blackface minstrel performances in Quebec's past decade is one thing, but presenting ignorance as fact in order to castigate a blog post is actually entirely predictable to me and many women of color accustomed to accusations that we are angry about nothing, a tactic deeply connected to the silencing of voices that point out manifestations of racism in Quebec society today. Denying that the slave trade was brought to Quebec is particularly striking given that just last month, France, the ancestral homeland of Les Habitants, commemorated the International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition. French President François Hollande spoke at the 7th annual commemoration and was the first leader of a Western government to call the transatlantic slave trade a crime against humanity, describing Le Code Noir as a code that reduced slaves to the status of objects. The reaction against Dauphin's article by Quebecers is emblematic of the hostility toward claims made by black Canadians that both French and English Canada have a legacy of racism to reckon with. One wonders what the stakes are for those hell-bent on denying that slavery, blackface minstrelsy, and other forms of racial discrimination never arrived on Canada's shores. This is an ongoing discussion that we need to have. For Spitfire, this is Alyssa Clutterbuck.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
We're here to speak our truth and to say no to the silencing of our voices in a racist and sexist society.
Spoken word. Interview.
What's that?
Hot.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
Tune in to Spitfire every last Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.3 FM CKUT Radio.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 6:17 p.m. here in Montreal. Now, what can I say about growing up in Montreal? Well, I mean, I spent all of my life here, met all my friends, had my family, basically started my entire life. Personally, I thought I had it pretty easy. I mean, I had both parents at home, I had a chance to go to school, like I said before, I had my friends, and I had parents that wanted the best for me and made sure that I put my best foot forward. Essentially, what I had growing up was something special and what you could consider typical of most children, but not all. That is to say, there are many who may not have had all the opportunities that I had, but still may do in order to make the best out of their situation. And I do say that they did probably come out stronger than I ever did or could imagine. But I guess it is all a matter of opinion, especially when everyone's life experience is different. I mentioned earlier that I thought I had it easy growing up, but only because I had parents ensured that it was that way. I mean, they made sure that we kept active, we were involved in everything imaginable and had no excuse to say that we're bored at home, and essentially kept us out of trouble. In a sense, they were my modern day trailblazers, helping me maneuver myself in an otherwise dog-eat-dog world. You hear stories about how they faced difficulties as individuals coming from Trinidad to start a new chapter in their lives, only to be faced with discrimination and racism based on cultural differences or even because of the color of their skin. Now, when I was young, I didn't understand that, but I was lucky enough, and I use the term loosely, that as a young child, I did not have to encounter that. Where I lived in Little Burgundy, I was exposed to different cultures, languages, and people of different backgrounds, and was thus sensitive to understanding and respecting other people's differences without passing judgment, even if I may not have agreed with their opinions or beliefs. But this does not mean that these values were reciprocated back to me. It never really clicked why there were some children who were curious to why my hair was different to theirs, or why my gums are a different color, or even sometimes making fun of the plumpness of my lips. In my mind, I didn't pay any attention to this, because what they were saying to me just didn't make any sense. For me, I was just another human being, I was just like them, I was a person. But as I got older and started to conceptualize these types of comments, it came into me that for all of its diversity, culturally, religiously, and politically, it's still amazing to find out how much insensitivity and common sense racism still persists in Montreal. Now, we've been hearing recently about all the controversy with the turban used in soccer and then having it disproven by FIFA, an international body for soccer, saying there's nothing wrong with it. Or even as Alyssa mentioned earlier with Nydia's article. I mean, I feel like we're in a day and age where these kind of things shouldn't have to happen, or we shouldn't be making a big deal about it because we're exposed to each other differently, who are different, and we should be able to respect each other in a sense that we should be treating each other as human beings, and as such, we should be able to give each other that space. Now, as I said earlier, I was lucky enough to grow up in a neighborhood where I had all these chances to kind of grow mentally, spiritually, and whatever else you want to call it. But I know there's still some people out there who are still stuck in this bubble, and you want to say that it's not their fault, it's how they were raised. But I don't really buy that, because we live in a time and age where we're exposed to different resources where we can educate ourselves and make sure that we aren't making the same mistakes as in the past, because right now all that's happening is this never-ending cycle of controversy and trying to make someone feel like less of a person because of their skin type or because they believe in something different. And, you know, Montreal is a place where everyone is supposed to be able to be an individual. And I think we should keep reminding ourselves of that and just keep that in mind the next time we decide to make a controversy out of nothing.
Word.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you so much, Mercedes, for that beautiful testimonial.
You're welcome.
I'm going to cry.
Too much.
And also a big shout out to Alyssa Clutterback for her amazing and hilarious piece on her response to the denials that blackface, slavery, and other forms of anti-black racism is a part of Quebec history. So thank you so much, Alyssa. That was really informative and super funny and sad at the same time, of course. So I wanted to introduce this next piece. Jan Wong was one of Globe and Mail's most recognizable voices. After her piece on the Dawson shooting in 2006, she became clinically depressed and was fired from the publication. She chronicles these events in her latest book, Out of the Blue. And we have a review written by our wonderful collective member, Lily Dow, who's down in New York right now. We love you, Lily. That will be read by Malek Yalowi.
In 2006, journalist Jan Wong wrote an article in the Globe and Mail about the Dawson school shooting. The article would eventually lead to her getting fired from the Globe and Mail. It would also leave her spiraling into clinical depression, something she discusses in her memoir, Out of the Blue, released in May of 2012. Jan Wong was no small fry. At 19, she traveled to China to become the first Canadian to study there during the Cultural Revolution. She became a news assistant at the newly opened New York Times Bureau in Beijing. She was a staff reporter for the Boston Globe and the Wall Street Journal. She was also the Globe and Mail's Beijing bureau chief during the 90s. She was an eyewitness to and wrote about the Tiananmen Square massacre. Her book, Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now, was on the Times top 10 books of 1996. By the time she wrote the piece about the Dawson shooting, she had been a journalist for over 30 years. She was also the only visible minority, as she herself puts it, among the 58 columnists listed on the Globe and Mail's website at the time. So what happened to Jan Wong? Wong wrote an article covering the Dawson shooting. The following passage would become the object of intense nationwide criticism. Wong wrote, "What many outsiders don't realize is how alienating the decades-long linguistic struggle has been in the once cosmopolitan city. It hasn't just taken a toll on longtime Anglophones, it's affected immigrants too. To be sure, the shootings in all three cases were carried out by mentally disturbed individuals. But what is also true is that in all three cases, the perpetrator was not pure Lane, the argot for a pure Francophone. Elsewhere, to talk of racial purity is repugnant, not in Quebec. To be sure, Mr. Le Pen hated women. Mr. Fabricant hated his engineering colleagues, and Mr. Gill hated everyone. But all of them had been marginalized in a society that deeply valued pure Lane. The criticism she received was often personal and racist. She and the Globe received hundreds of hate emails and letters. Many were exhorting her to go back to China. Wong also received death threats. Wong details in her book how her newspaper turned its back on her and distanced itself from her article. The article had, however, properly gone through the editorial process. She mentions how her editor even encouraged her to write more on the pure Lane angle. The Globe's editor-in-chief, Edward Greenspan, would eventually publicly acknowledge that the controversial passage should not have been printed. One website from Quebec called for a boycott on her father's restaurant in Montreal, which eventually shut its doors some 3 months after the article was published. The website stated, "Perhaps they try to take revenge against Pure Lane Quebecois stock in selling cat or rat disguised as chicken." The political response was extraordinary. Jean Charest, Premier of Quebec at the time, demanded an apology from her and wrote a letter to the Globe. The House of Commons also passed a unanimous motion demanding that she apologize to Quebec for her article. The reaction of the press was also remarkable, with journalists from pretty much every major Montreal daily condemning her article. Le Devoir published a cartoon of her with thick glasses and buck teeth, opening a fortune cookie with the message, "Beware of Bill 101." The caption read, "Jeanne Wong, enquêtant sur le Québec." What is fascinating about the whole incident, which came to be known as L'Affaire Wong, was the magnitude of the backlash. Even if you disagree with Wong's analysis, why was her article so heavily condemned in a culture that is supposedly committed to ideals of free speech and the exchange of ideas? Why not simply dismiss it as bad journalism? Why were her Chinese background and her family affected? The reaction may just point to the fact that it is taboo to suggest that Quebec's linguistic and cultural policies may have adverse effects on immigrants and racialized people. This taboo may be even more intense for people from these communities. But this is precisely the discussion that needs to be had in a place where political leaders constantly discuss the importance of preserving French Quebecois culture. This raises so many questions. Who's part of this culture? Am I part of this Quebecois culture if I can speak French? Is that actually enough? And what does this idea of preserving a Quebecois culture imply for cultural and racial pluralism? What does it mean for racialized and immigrant communities for Quebec to favor interculturalism over multiculturalism? Interculturalism, as some Quebec thinkers understand it, is the concept that there is one acknowledged dominant culture and that immigrant groups should be integrated into this culture while respecting their diversity to a certain extent. Multiculturalism, on the other hand, does not theoretically imply the existence of one dominant culture. In 2011, Parti Québécois MNA Louise Baudouin declared to reporters that multiculturalism is not a Quebec value. How can diversity be respected in the face of a dominant culture? How and who chooses what forms of diversity are worth respecting and what aren't? Often debates about multiculturalism are framed around immigrants needing to adapt, to integrate to host communities. Even if this is taken as valid, it fails to address the perspectives of quote-unquote allophones who were born in Quebec or those from racialized communities that have been in Quebec for centuries because of many factors, including slavery. They are not immigrants adapting to a host culture. They were born in Quebec. Is Quebec culture a dynamic one that includes them? Do they have a real claim to Quebec identity? And if these issues are constantly framed in terms of Anglophone or Francophone interests, what or who gets lost? How are minoritarian interests represented politically? A quick scan of members of the National Assembly reveals a true dearth of representatives from racialized communities. The same can be said of members of the judiciary. These are the kinds of questions that need to be asked and openly debated in Quebec. This is how we can, for example, start addressing how racism functions in Quebec and how it is distinct. As Professor Charmaine Nelson wrote in a recent Huffington Post article about Mario Jean's blackface impersonation of Boucar Diaf at the Gala des Oliviers last May, recalling our colonial histories and challenging the disturbing reemergence of blackface is not Quebec bashing. Is that where we are in 2013? Does being a true Quebecois imply complicity in the silence surrounding Quebec's colonial histories and contemporary forms and practices of racism? Another important aspect of Jeanne Wong's book is the real impact of racialized harassment on women of color. Jeanne Wong relates how she started to emotionally fall apart when critics started targeting her family and her father's business. She was especially struck by the racialized nature of these attacks. Wong's story is about the consequences of racism and how it can and does impact one's health. It's about the aftermath of racialized aggression, something that is often underemphasized. It's also a captivating story. Out of the Blue, which was dumped by Jeanne Wong's publisher days before it was supposed to be released, and which Wong published herself, hit the Toronto Star and Globe and Mail bestseller list.
something to believe in. Heaven saw that reason that was time to bear it all for your dreams. Cut the keys then, bangs tease. Winter's cool breeze, free as a bird with nothing but time. I'm safe keeping. Found my way seeking, darkened days of leaving. Rain boots dancing, muddy clay kept daydreaming. He said, I heard you leaving. I said, yeah, not eating right in the big city for years. No longer pretty that way for heat. Take turn, my time to speak. Burn sometimes, I wind through streets, unkind memories. Grind to eat, make two new beginnings. No time to sleep, awake takes two forgiving. Taking time to read, heartbreaking work, a staggering genius. But again, I'll always mean it when I tell you that I like to. From the day that we met, I bet you think I say the things I forget. And try my best this time, cross my heart and hope for signs. Rope is open down, soak the grime out, rug to dry. Just to get by, bumping quality out of speakers, timber. Peace to all the spirits gone, well, they sometimes linger. Rain season, apologies, reason, post-data, can't remember, yeah, I've been until November, shit.
Hanging out all of Montreal in the fall, now we're free to be chasing it all, so long to yesterday, sipping wine in the middle of day, life is so much better this way, so long, he said, hanging out Montreal in the fall.
Breeze, the changing times, the changing leaves. I'm a baby to me, the pots are ripened. Just the peach, the sea grows juicy indeed. Summer, how you leave me soft in slumber. Turn my back, you were gone. Paper stacks, not forgotten for this love thing. Look above, my night still closing in. Where does it end, where to begin? Montreal daylight fights within. Wine and cheese in the day, Port Royal in the bay. Belle Provence, vous commencez ça. Dépanneur, comme vous ne pensez pas. Spotlight and fancy cars, LA bigger stars, preteen push up bras, that life ain't for me. Sharp in life, but quite a journey. Spark in flight, a riot churning, one fire burning. No lie of a word, my story hurt, these years they turn.
Hanging out all of Montreal in the fall, now we're free to be chasing it all. So long to yesterday, sipping wine.
Ma is in the living room. She is angry. She is pulsing. She looks tough. The bruises of her anger apparent like swollen lumps on either sides of her cheeks. Yet, even through her own vexations, there is warmth, and it surges through her. She is a needy love. She is a confused love. The pain of unfulfillment travels fast through her blazing eyes. Every blink, every smile, every thousand-yard stare is a call to love. Alyssa, please don't wear that. Alyssa laughs at her. She's uncompromising to this woman, a stranger. Alyssa, please don't be rude, sweetheart. Oh, Mom. Condescending. Oh, Mom. You're an idiot. Oh, Mom. What is wrong with you? Oh, Mom. I'm the best thing that ever happened to you. Oh, Mom. You're nothing without me. So much to say in such few little words. Alyssa. What's wrong, Mom? You're acting like a fucking cunt. I'm not there and there at the same time. I don't register. My facial expression remains intact, removed. I'm on Alyssa's side no matter what. Besides, what's a cunt anyway? I woke up and remembered that memory. It felt like a dream, lived, a past life. I couldn't remember how old I was, but I knew I was old enough to do something. Or at least to know that what Alyssa was doing was wrong. As I lay there, not doing much of anything, I replayed it all in my mind. I tried to isolate the images of my mother that have formed in my brain. My mind focused on Alyssa, but I refocused it on Mama. She didn't do anything when Alyssa threw those words at her, assaulting the air, cutting through the energy like a slice of a guillotine, running fast past towards gravity. She just stood. The liquid around her eyes rose, creating a film that sat there on the edge of the cliff, floating in the space between the lashes and her eyeball. I rewatched her every move in my mind, haunted by her composition, disturbed by her preciseness, and for the first time I realized that she was used to this. Her face didn't transform into a mask of pain, but there was a heartache etched all over. She bit her lips in a bid to pace the tears, and when Alyssa swiftly exited the room, laughing perniciously, my mother let the tears rain over her. I was there that day. I just sat as if I wasn't. It wasn't my fight. It wasn't my war. But I let my mother weep and mourn, already at loss for a child who had gone astray.
Thank you so much, Faria Rosine.
Woohoo! Woohoo!
Thank you.
Faria Rosine is super talented at doing impersonations of British men, fangirling, and writing semi-decent film reviews, preferably about films with hot men in them. She's written for The Huffington Post, IndieWire, Filmmaker Magazine, Quip Mag, Afropunk, and the Film Society of the Lincoln Center. She's also written a book, which people tell her is pretty impressive. You've been listening to excerpts of Like a Bird, read by the illustrious Faria Rosine herself. I bumped into her in the street due to her utter charm and charisma. Critic, writer, podcaster, and multifaceted in her identity, she's live in studio with us today. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Music in the background for this interview.
Yeah, we also just have... checking out Faria's Tumblr. Amazing.
Yeah, so welcome to Spitfire, Faria.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and where you're coming from?
Oh, okay, sure. Well, I just moved here from New York 4 months ago. I don't know. What do you want to know? Ask me questions. How do I introduce myself?
What were we just hearing?
I actually wanted to read more, but I felt like I was taking too much time. It's from my debut novel, Like a Bird, and it's about a girl, a woman of color, who is brutally raped and then disowned by her family.
Wow.
Yeah, and the story is of her basically, it starts off right at the beginning, the rape and then the being disowned. And then the whole novel pretty much focuses on her coming to terms with it and finding herself essentially through a very destructive, moment. And the reason I started writing that was because at a very young age, I understood that there was something wrong with the rape. But that there wasn't enough for women. There wasn't a social platform to talk about it. And so I decided that I wanted to write a book in order to sort of give women room to talk about these destructive things that have happened to them. I've just actually maybe 2 weeks ago, I wrote an article for Huffington Post about Lindy West, this comedian who writes for Jezebel, and the backlash that she got after she said that people shouldn't make rape into comedy, like it shouldn't ever be a part of a comedy act. And I've my article was talking about how, you know, I had actually gone to a comedy show where that had happened, and then my friend afterwards was sort of took me to the side and said I was gang raped, and that was just like, you know, you never know because nobody talks about it, you know? So it's something that I am very passionate about, and that's what my novel is about.
Wow. That's super intense.
Yeah, it's really intense.
How long did it take you to do the sort of the research and the reflecting in order to, you know, engage with this topic?
Well, it's, one could say that it's never ending. Mm. I'm constantly, you know, aware of this because my mind is so attuned to sort of you know, there's never enough information that you can find, mm-hmm. and never enough stories, you know.
Right.
One of the most beautiful things I've experienced is, like, women coming to me as a source of, like, comfort and being like, okay, I think that you will understand. Can I tell you my story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, you know, friends have done that. People, like, complete strangers that I've met at parties, you know, just, like, openly telling me, you know, these, like, tragedies in their lives they can't tell anybody else because nobody else will really listen. Mm. Families are so quick to sort of judge, especially, I feel like, unfortunately, sort of the communities that maybe we come from, you know, yeah. our families are, you know, so much of, I mean, growing up for me, I was hypersexualized at a young age purely because of that's the way that my parents think everything is sort of overly sexual, you know?
Right.
And so it's a woman's fault, essentially. I mean, no, I would doubt that my parents would say that.
Don't tempt men.
Exactly. No, exactly.
By
you know?
Being born.
Don't, by yeah, breathing. Like, my dad lives in Dubai, and whenever I go there, it's like, I have to, you know, it's just natural now, but, like, I can't wear certain things, because if a man looks at me, that's my fault, mm-hmm. you know? So... it's interesting to sort of, yeah, see women come out, because everybody wants to talk about it. Nobody can, though.
Right.
Or not yet.
So, what's, like, the background of your main character?
Well, she's half Indian, half, just American. And that, the dichotomy of sort of having dual backgrounds is something that I relate to too, and so even just being a child of the West but also child of, like, immigrant parents, you know, is mm-hmm. a dichotomy right. that we all struggle with.
Third space.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's something that I am, like, trying to delve into, because it's taken me a while to sort of figure out that sort of affects everything in my life.
Doesn't
you know
it, though?
I come from, like, mm-hmm. this I think that when you're young, you're sort of trying to figure out, why do I feel so strange? What is wrong? Yeah. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, fuck. Sorry. Am I allowed to say that? I'm just going to say that anyway.
It's happened. Let's move on.
Uh-oh.
I mean, you know, that this has affected every...
person of color who's grown up in the West.
Yes. Essentially, yeah.
Can you characterize it some more, just for our listeners? The strangeness.
A feeling at loss in a way, because you're never quite understood. You know, there is, like, this vagueness and this abstractness to you, and everybody kind of looks at you as if you are this thing, and it is an alienation, because. I mean, it really frustrates me when, and I know everybody has, like, their own little quirks that they hate. Stop myself. That they hate. You know, I personally hate it when people say, "Oh my God, I love your skin." Oh, your skin color is so
totally understandable, because yeah. then it's like your differences are highlighted 10 times more yeah. than they need to be
yeah.
to make you feel like you're just on display 24/7.
Oh my God, your skin. Oh, what I wouldn't do to have your skin color. Oh my
Temporarily,
God.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of it. They want the skin, but they don't want what comes with it.
Exactly.
That's the irony, I think. And that's something that I delve into on my podcast with my friend Ziba, which is called Two Brown Girls.
Yeah, let's hear more about that.
Publicize that. Two Brown Girls. Two Brown Girls. Follow us on Twitter or whatever.
Tumblr.com?
Yeah. I mean, just Google us. We're
you're there.
Doing well enough to be Googled. it's basically, we are women of color, and we talk about popular culture and film.
Mm-hmm.
We're both film critics, and so we like talking about Hollywood and the lack of people of color within Hollywood. And
can I just say, deja vu moment? right here on the show, because that was like the topic of one of our shows, like last month, actually.
Yeah.
2 months ago.
For sure.
Yeah, you should have had me.
We will from now on.
From now on. Because that's also, even within my film criticism, whoever I tend to write for, I kind of bring that angle in. And I think it's incredibly important for us to push Hollywood. And you know, there's still things like blackface, yellow, you know, like Cloud Atlas last year came out. It was all of the characters were like either in yellow face or, you know, black. Halle Berry was in white face and she thought that that was the reason why it was okay.
Beige face.
But she's just like, this is fine. And like,
no, it's not.
It's not. It's never not. You know, it's never okay.
Yeah, I never saw the film because it looked so bad.
Yeah, you did a good thing. Yeah.
That trailer was like a bad acid trip. It's like a bad acid trip, and Halle Berry is in it. And who's that other guy?
And Tom, I mean, a lot of famous people were in Cloud Atlas.
It was in my bad acid trip that lasted for a 2-minute trailer, yeah.
But, you know, and then, like, very Star Trek, Benedict Cumberbatch, his character, you know, is actually not white. You know, he's Star Trek, and the irony behind that is Star Trek was one of the important
landmark
television shows for, you know, trying to bring people of color, you know, into the forefront. And so that's really sad that the film versions haven't been able to do the same.
Yeah, so check it out, Two Brown Girls on Tumblr. Google it. It's mm-hmm. hilarious. I listened to one of your podcasts. You guys just went off on Pharrell's latest album, Yeezus. That was really funny.
Oh, Kanye's, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Kanye, sorry. And, yeah, I wanted to ask you, like, two more questions before we sign off here.
Sure.
I kind of know a little bit about how you were in law school and then you dropped it to become a writer. And I think it's just really important to share that story. Just for people out there who maybe wouldn't take that, that path, you know, to pursue their art.
We opened up on Two Brown Girls. A lot of people write to me. I get, like, you know, I hate to call it fan mail, but yeah, it's like I get fan mail and people like are like, how did you do this? How did you become a writer? How did you drop out of school? How did you drop out of law school, essentially? Like,
did I say that? Was I allowed to say that? Do your parents know
yet?
Yeah,
my parents know.
Well, now they do.
Hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. I'll call you in 5 minutes. It's been a struggle, and it's still a struggle. It's a constant struggle, and that is a very unique thing for people of color, especially, you know, coming from the background that I come from. Education is so paramount to who you are. You know, if you're not educated, I mean, I think, you know, your parents are right. Like, you know, in order to be anything in life, you need education because you're a person of color.
Right.
And so I totally understand and respect where they're coming from. But I quickly became disillusioned with law and with my peers who are all asses. And I'm slowly realizing I swear a lot.
That's okay.
They are not nice people, and I don't want to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be a human rights lawyer. That was always the plan, but it's so difficult to make a difference, unfortunately, in human rights law. Exactly. And so I feel as though I've actually created more of a niche for myself within writing and been able to kind of do more in the, like, last 2 years that I've, like, actually, you know, found my feet in writing. And hopefully, you know, from now on, it's like even more, you know, I think with the book getting published soon, hopefully, you know, things will really kind of, I'll be able to make the impact that I want to make. And that is just purely to help and give, you know, women of color, people of color, women, you know, a place. Mm.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. This has been such a fun interview. I've had so much fun getting to know you more, and I'm so happy that you have newly just arrived here in Montreal.
Welcome.
Thank you. From your NY dates. So, yeah, follow Faria Roisin and her...
Yeah, follow me on Twitter or...
Mofa-fa-fa-fa.
Exactly, Mofa-fa-fa-fa-fa.
Four fives, y'all, four fives.
And she also has a personal blog called Lady Moustache.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thanks a lot.
No, thank you.
You get the wake-up call. Maybe saw the bills fall. A boat crash with the final call. Get your money, dollar bill, y'all. Both crash with the final call. Get your money, dollar bill, y'all. To my folks on the picket line. Don't stop till you change their mind. Got love for my phone. Baptized when the levees broke. We gon' keep marching on until you hear that freedom song. And if you think about turning back, I got the shotgun on.
You are listening to Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. Precedent-setting complaint of race and gender identity bias filed against Quebec Rental Board judge. A precedent-setting civil rights case that could significantly contribute to the fight against race and gender identity-based discrimination in Quebec was filed by Ms. Tommy Sojourner. A black lesbian management consultant, Ms. Sojourner has filed a complaint of judicial bias with the Conseil de la Justice Administrative, the Administrative Judicial Council, against a member of the rental board for the latter's conduct during a hearing held on June 11, 2013. During the hearing, Ms. Sojourner was repeatedly subject to demeaning and disrespectful conduct by the presiding judge, who referred to Ms. Sojourner using masculine pronouns at least a dozen times in a 15-minute hearing. Pronouns included Monsieur, he, and Mr. throughout the hearing, despite being informed by both Ms. Sojourner and the landlord's representative to refer to her simply as Madame Sojourner. The judge's gestures and comments led Ms. Sojourner to conclude that she had been discriminated against and denied access to a fair and impartial hearing. Ms. Sojourner will be available to discuss her case with journalists Wednesday, June 26, 2013 at 10 a.m. You missed it, y'all, at the CRRA office. We'll be bringing you more on this story as it develops.
And that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you to our contributors, guests, as well as many others who made this show possible.
Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca. That's spitfiyah@ckut.ca. And check out www.spitfire.blogspot.com.
Peace!
Turn me up. I wanna hear the music.
Yeah.
I wanna feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
Yeah,
we're here.
All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.
Nothing gained, nothing tried. Very few even try. Most just wanna get high. From the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave. And I'm not gonna.
thwart me or snake me. Either way, I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. No sweat the cream. Just set the scene. Get some cream like how you mean. Straight up, one of the best that's been. Ain't no puppet on a string. Like them hoes sucking on your thing. Overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave. People screaming hardcore, living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought I was gonna rise? Do my thing, get my piece of the pie. If you're holding your breath for great God out the sky, best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow a lot of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. And just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, scheming on the come up. No daydreaming, got to stay one up. How you gonna sit back and wait on the wealth? Gotta go get it, motivate yourself. If not, you only perpetrate yourself. And at the end of the day, you only hate yourself. If you know me, you know my motto. Take in charge. You got what it takes to make it, make it all. The world got a problem, and it's yours. That's why I wrote this rhyme. You can quote this line, cause I focus line. Living in some hopeless times, or so it seems. Never let go of your dreams, nah, man. Nah, man. Just do what you got to do.